Benefits have expired as the pandemic intensifies, but Senate Republicans in the White House have refused to advance multiple relief measures passed by the Democrat-controlled House. On Friday, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took to the House floor to call out Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for sending the Senate home for Thanksgiving without finalizing a coronavirus relief bill.
Our country is going hungry on the week before Thanksgiving, and the Senate broke. I don't care what party you are. It is an abandonment of our responsibilities as elected officials who are charged with acting in the public trust.
AOC is wearing all black. Public Citizen recently tweeted in all capital letters, "Why is the Senate on vacation while Americans are dying with no relief?" We have 10 seconds, Rob Weissman.
It's unconscionable. We've got rising hunger, rising homelessness, tens of millions of people out of work. The Senate has refused to act on the bill to pass the House in May, and people are going to suffer as a result. Hopefully, we can get a deal done quickly, but this is all resting at the feet of Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump.
We have to leave it there. Rob Weissman, president of Public Citizen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Help me now, baby. You gotta help me, 'cause I need somebody. I need you right now. Come on in. Let me know that you need me, dude. I'm gonna tell you this one.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee will meet on Tuesday, November 24th at 4:30 instead of the third Thursday this month. Please visit our website at kboo.fm. to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon legislature is considering extending the state's eviction moratorium through the end of June. Michigan has certified Joe Biden's victory in the state, and COVID-19 continues to spread, with Oregon reporting a record 1,517 new cases on Sunday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 23rd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. AstraZeneca became the third pharmaceutical company to announce positive results from late-stage trials of a coronavirus vaccine. The company developed the vaccine along with Oxford University. They say it is 70% effective overall, with up to 90% efficacy in a smaller group that got a lower dosage. Differing trial designs make direct comparison difficult, but even with somewhat lower protection, the AstraZeneca vaccine may be a more realistic option for much of the world. This is because it is likely to be less expensive, it does not need to be stored at sub-zero temperatures, and it can be kept in storage for up to 6 months. The Oxford AstraZeneca team said that its vaccine offered 90% protection against the coronavirus when a subject received half a dose, followed by a full dose 1 month later. Efficacy was lower at 62% when subjects received two full doses 1 month apart. AstraZeneca said it will begin seeking emergency authorization in the U.S. The vaccine is already in production, so if approved, the first 4 million doses could be ready in December, and another 40 million could be delivered in the first quarter of 2021. AstraZeneca added that no participants in the trial who received the vaccine developed severe cases of COVID-19 or required hospitalization. They also said that no serious safety events were reported in connection with the vaccine. Both Pfizer and its partner, BioNTech, have asked the Food and Drug Administration to grant an emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine, which is found to be 95% effective. A second vaccine from Moderna is expected to be submitted for emergency authorization soon as well. Moncef Slaoui is the chief scientific advisor for Operation Warp Speed. He said on Sunday that some Americans could start receiving a coronavirus vaccine by the second week of December. Slaoui told CNN, quote, "Our plan is to be able to ship vaccines to the immunization sites within 24 hours from the approval, so I would expect maybe on a day or two after the approval on the 11th or the 12th of December," end quote. Slaoui added that while millions could be vaccinated in the months following an emergency use authorization, it would be well into 2021 before the nation would be able to achieve herd immunity. For herd immunity, around 70% of the population would have to be vaccinated. After authorization, the COVID-19 vaccine would first be given to high-risk individuals, including healthcare workers, the elderly, and those with underlying conditions. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 1,174 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 66,333. Oregon health officials also reported 6 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 826. While the daily total marks the 6th day in a row with more than 1,000 cases reported, it is down significantly from Sunday's record-breaking total of 1,517 new cases. The counties with the most number of cases reported were Multnomah with 254, Washington County with 225, Marion County with 120, and Clackamas County with 116 cases. Health officials also reported that 456 patients were hospitalized with COVID-19 across Oregon, with 109 patients in intensive care. Nationally, case numbers are spiking across the country. The U.S. surpassed 12.4 million cases on Monday, with more than 257,000 deaths. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 171,000 cases reported per day, an increase of 54% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 59 million people in nearly every country. As of Monday afternoon, at least 1.3 million people have died across the world. Oregon lawmakers are considering extending the state's eviction moratorium through June 30, 2021. The proposal was unveiled on Friday. It would extend the state's current eviction ban, now scheduled to expire on December 31st. It would also offer partial repayments to landlords who have not collected rental income. Renters financially hurt by the pandemic would be safe from eviction for not paying rent through June. However, for some, that would mean they owe a full year of back rent on July 1st. According to a summary released by House Speaker Tina Kotek's office, the proposal would require renters who want immunity from evictions to submit a sworn statement that they experienced financial hardship after March 16, 2020, when Governor Kate Brown issued an emergency declaration due to the pandemic. Valid reasons include medical bills, loss of income, and increased child care or elder care responsibilities and costs. The addition of a sworn statement is a notable change to Oregon's current system of offering blanket protection to renters. This is a move landlords have been promoting, but it could mean that tenants will not be aware of how to protect themselves from eviction. Renters who do not qualify for the eviction ban past December 31st would have until March 31st, 2021 to pay off back rent. They would also be responsible for paying the current monthly rent as of January 1st. Landlords who intend to pursue eviction due to non-payment of rent would have to give renters 15 days' notice, which is more than is currently required. Landlords would also have increased options for evicting people without cause than have been allowed under the current eviction moratorium, including demolishing or converting their units. In addition, the proposal would allocate $100 million from the state's general fund to assist renters and landlords. Legislators have said it is likely that the bulk of that money would go into a new landlord compensation fund. The Portland Police Bureau released its annual report of stop and search data last week, revealing a disproportionate number of stops of Black Portlanders. The report covers demographics from all 2019 traffic and non-traffic related stops. Traffic related stops of Black Portlanders have been on an upward trend since 2014, and last year Black drivers constituted 11.2% of PPB stops, nearly double the estimated percentage of the Portland demographic mix. In contrast, traffic stops of white Portlanders have trended downward since 2014, while the total population of white Portlanders has continued to grow. The Bureau uses census and employment data to determine benchmark percentages of racial groups using the roads. It also collects crime victimization data and injury collision statistics to tune those benchmarks for non-traffic related stops. By comparing actual stop demographics to these benchmarks, the Bureau can analyze disparities in who gets stopped. The PPB report acknowledged that road demographics most likely swing even higher in favor of whites, as they are more likely to be tourists and commuters. Non-traffic-related stops by Portland police followed similar trends. The number of Black Portlanders stopped increased, while the number of white Portlanders stopped decreased. Black Portlanders made up over 20% of all non-traffic-related stops. These stops usually involve suspicion of a crime rather than a driving violation. The report also found more stops of Black drivers than white drivers in minor, non-moving violations. This category was highlighted as identifying bias, as police use their own discretion in choosing who to target for these stops. Discretionary searches can also indicate police bias, as officers choose which individuals to search. In 2019, discretionary searches were conducted on Black and Native Portlanders at far higher rates than other groups, even though contraband was most often found among whites. An additional report by the Gun Violence Reduction Team showed that 52% of all stops made by the GVRT were of Black Portlanders. The report noted that all data collected on race was self-reported by the officers involved in stop and searches. Police may misidentify a person in a traffic stop the same way Black protesters were misidentified as white or other races during arrests this summer. In a press release last week, Portland police acknowledged that stops and searches of Black Portlanders are significantly higher than those of other racial groups, but they stopped short of calling out the numbers disparities. The Bureau plans to collect additional data points in the coming year to further identify solutions. TriMet has announced plans to move forward with a pilot program providing mobile crisis response teams for riders experiencing mental health crisis. The agency hopes these teams will increase community safety as it seeks to reduce the involvement of armed transit police in situations that require de-escalation and nuance. The program is a continuation of TriMet's Reimagining Public Safety initiative started this summer in response to racial justice demonstrations in Portland. In June, Mayor Ted Wheeler announced the withdrawal of the Portland Police Bureau from the Tri-County Transit Police as a part of police reforms planned by the City Council. By the end of the year, all PPB officers staffing the transit division will be reassigned, and leadership of the division will be transferred to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Shortly after this decision was made, TriMet announced it was divesting $1.8 million from its transit police budget in lieu of community-based safety options. TriMet used extensive public feedback from online rider surveys, focus groups, and community organizations to make its plans. As a result, the Transit Public Safety Advisory Committee formed a plan of 25 recommendations for improvements ranging from increased lighting at transit stops to increased staff presence in the new mobile crisis response team. Survey respondents of color were far more likely to say they felt unsafe when riding public transit. Both TriMet employees and riders responded that an increased presence of support staff would make them feel more comfortable. While it may work in tandem with the new Portland Street Response, TriMet directors say they would like to see a, quote, transit-focused model that gains the trust of both riders and transit operators. Transit police will still respond to emergencies and criminal activity on TriMet property. A more thorough plan, including budgeting, will be presented in 9 months. The pilot program is expected to be ready by 2023. Houseless people at three city-run campsites will soon have access to a new temporary housing option to stave off the cold. The Joint Office of Homeless Services have purchased 40 pods as temporary emergency housing. The pods are made of aluminum and feature lighting and electric heating. They're small in size and don't have a toilet or running water. The pods are a solution aimed at protecting the houseless community from both the cold and from COVID-19. Normally, the city will open warming shelters on the coldest days of the year to keep houseless people from dying in the cold. The pandemic and social distancing makes this significantly harder. The city is able to offer fewer shelter beds to those who need it. Portland has asked the business community for help with options for creating new temporary emergency shelter spots. Many office buildings in the city now sit vacant due to the coronavirus pandemic. Still, the shelter pods are a creative new option for the city to establish support for houseless people in the cold. City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty said of the new pods, quote, "We know how important it is to provide our houseless community members with a safe, humane, and dignified living space, especially as we enter cold weather conditions. I appreciate the work that has gone into finding creative solutions like these shelter pods to make sure these villagers are able to get through both the harsh winter weather and COVID-19," end quote. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for KBOO News In Depth. Two U.S. senators have asked for a formal investigation into rehab facilities that use patients for unpaid labor. We look at the story behind it. At 6, stick around, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 52. Today in history, the first issue of the pictorial magazine Life is published, featuring a cover photo of the Fort Peck Dam spillway by Margaret Bourke White. Life ceased running as a weekly publication in 1972 when it began losing its audience and advertising to television. Today, much of its archive is viewable online. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist Rosa Parks, who said, quote, "To bring about change, you must not be afraid to take the first step. We will fail when we fail to try." The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends Americans celebrate Thanksgiving at home this year, and health officials urge the public to pass the turkey virtually. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
Health officials recommend people celebrate Thanksgiving virtually this year rather than traveling. COVID-19 cases have surged in recent weeks, prompting Governor Jay Inslee to issue statewide restrictions until mid-December. Peter Barquette, an internal medicine doctor in Silverdale for Kaiser Permanente, says people should stay home, noting if they wouldn't feel comfortable getting together on any other day, they shouldn't get together because it's a holiday.
A typical Thanksgiving gathering where people are around the table eating or spending more time together, these are all things that increase the rate of transmission, and that's why I think it's especially high risk.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also is advising people to celebrate Thanksgiving at home. Barquette says they would have needed to start quarantining on November 12th in order to travel and celebrate the holiday with family on Thursday. Barquette knows it's going to be hard not seeing family during the holiday, but he says people should still stay in touch with family members. One of his favorite parts of Thanksgiving is trading dishes, so Barquette is swapping recipes with family members in other parts of the country.
I'm going to try actually cooking some of those recipes. And for family members who are in town, we're actually going to be doing some dish swaps, so kind of leaving things at the front door for each other.
Barquette recognizes people are feeling COVID-19 fatigue, but adds that news of effective vaccines means the end of the pandemic could be just over the horizon.
Now is the time to really redouble our efforts at preventing the spread of COVID and finish strong so that when the vaccine is available, we're in a good place to finally get this virus and pandemic behind us.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The statewide election board in Michigan votes to certify the state's election today. This is a major blow to President Trump's efforts to thwart the results of the November presidential election. Certification is a process that paves the way for the state's electors to go to the Electoral College. Michigan will almost certainly give its 16 electoral votes to President-elect Joe Biden. Ahead of the certification, the board heard from county clerks from around the state who addressed how the electoral process was handled from county to county. Just last week, Wayne County, the home of Detroit, was the site of some serious back and forth about certifying the votes there. Commissioners were taken to task by angry citizens on Zoom for holding up the election process. Eventually, they conceded and certified the county's votes. At the state level, the vote was 3-0, with one Republican member abstaining. Republican Aaron Van Langeveld voted for certification with two Democratic colleagues. He said before casting his vote, quote, "As John Adams once said, we are a government of laws, not men. This board needs to adhere to that principle here today and comply with our legal duty to certify this election." Several other swing states will certify their vote counts in the coming weeks, like Wisconsin, Nevada, and Arizona, with Pennsylvania expected to be the next in line. The Trump campaign is running out of legal options as more states certify their election results. With more on the story, it's the 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The nation has spoken. We have to come together in peace and in unity, and we have to walk together. And I would hope and I would urge my former colleagues in the State House, in the State Senate, to put down their arms and join with the democracy of America.
With Michigan's State Board of Canvassers deciding today whether to certify their election, Flint Mayor Sheldon Neely and other community leaders and pastors asked state leadership to reject claims of voter fraud. Over the weekend, the Republican state and national parties requested a 14-day delay in the state certification. This despite Michigan Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield, both Republicans, saying they had no information that would change the outcome of the election after President Trump personally lobbied them last week. Other senior GOP lawmakers are also starting to condemn Trump's attempts to overturn the election results.
It feels like more and more are beginning to speak out, but this is not a partisan issue anymore. We have never seen a politician try to subvert the will of the voters in this fashion.
More Republican officials need to come forward, says Vanita Gupta, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Pennsylvania's certification deadline is also today. A federal judge dismissed the most recent Trump campaign lawsuit there with a withering critique, saying no evidence of election fraud or misconduct was even presented. Rudy Giuliani, Trump's lawyer, said the ruling helps their strategy to get the case expeditiously to the Supreme Court. Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law President Kristen Clark calls the post-election litigation an affront to democracy.
We are literally seeing one of the biggest post-election attempts to disenfranchise voters en masse in modern time.
And she says the racial motivation underlying many of the lawsuits is undeniable.
It's not accidental that the public conversation around these suits continues to focus on the Atlanta metropolitan area, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Detroit, and other places that are home to large numbers of voters of color.
Nevada's deadline is tomorrow. Georgia certified their presidential votes last week after a hand recount and an audit. But taxpayers there will now pay for a third count to start next week at the request of the Trump campaign. The FBI and Georgia Bureau of Investigations are responding to threats made against Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican, and other election staff who stand behind the integrity of their election. Undeterred, hundreds of pro-Trump protesters gathered in Atlanta on Saturday for a so-called Stop the Steal rally, demanding that state officials call the election for Trump. On Twitter, Trump has called on state legislatures to intervene on his behalf. Trump typically uses his personal account, which is often retweeted by the official presidential handle at POTUS. Twitter announced that White House handle will automatically transfer to President-elect Joe Biden the moment he takes the oath of office on Inauguration Day. Biden's first cabinet picks are expected tomorrow. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
A judge has ruled in favor of a Southeast Alaska tribe, and tribal leaders and environmental groups celebrate a new Klamath River dam removal along the Oregon-California border. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A judge ruled the federal government was right to allow a Southeast Alaska tribe to organize a hunt out of season due to COVID-19. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, state attorneys have sued to block future hunts, arguing the special moose and deer harvest this summer was federal overreach.
During the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, a federally recognized tribe on Kuprinoff Island, was alarmed by the high price and low supply of fresh meat. The organized village of Cake petitioned the Federal Subsistence Board for a hunting party to harvest 5 deer and 2 moose out of season and distribute the meat within the community. It was greenlit in June. The state of Alaska filed suit alleging the feds had illegally preempted the state's rights to manage wildlife. Assistant Attorney General Cheryl Brooking says there are only narrow reasons for federal jurisdiction to trump state management.
When Alaska became a state, one of the main drivers of statehood was to get control over fish and game management because the feds were making a mess of it.
She argued in court filings that the food security issue was never proven, and the federal government exceeded its authority in allowing the hunt. District Court Judge Sharon L. Gleason denied a preliminary injunction that would have prevented special hunts in the future. She wrote that federal officials had taken both conservation and public safety concerns into account when it reached its decision. She also noted that when federal officials reached out to state wildlife managers, they didn't respond. It's not the end of the case. The lawsuit will continue to move forward, with both sides filing arguments before a final ruling. But the upshot is that federal officials aren't blocked from authorizing out-of-season hunts in special circumstances. Tribal leaders in Cake don't see that likely in the near future.
You know, we just got done with our moose season and our deer season, so I think we're good for now.
That's Cake's tribal president, Joel Jackson. He notes that the village's groceries are mainly shipped on the occasional state ferry or barge.
You know, if anything happens to those cranes down there where they load all the stuff coming to Alaska, we'd be in a world of hurt.
He says Alaska natives never voluntarily ceded their hunting and fishing rights on their traditional homeland.
Of course, if we're in a real bad situation, I wouldn't hesitate to just say, you know, get a hunting party together, go out and get the, what we need, you know. So, but I want to stay within the law, and if we could do that, that'd be great.
The Native American Rights Fund has joined the lawsuit on behalf of Cake's tribe and the federal government. In a Friday statement, a staff attorney wrote, Alaska Native communities are facing hardships caused by COVID-19 and encourage the state to treat tribes as partners, not adversaries. It's unclear if any future special hunts are being considered. Federal wildlife officials declined to comment, citing the state's litigation. I'm Jacob Resnick.
Tribal leaders, water protectors, and grassroots groups celebrated a new Klamath River Dam removal agreement between tribe states and the dam owner. Last week, leaders of the Yurok and Karuk tribes, the states of California and Oregon, and the dam owner announced an agreement to provide additional resources and support to advance salmon restoration, which includes dam removal. A virtual celebration was held Friday, hosted by the group Save California Salmon. Participants shared stories, songs, and paid tribute to water protectors. Vice Chairman of the Yurok Tribe, Frankie Myers.
The MOA itself and how we got here, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this was 20 years of work. This was water warriors, activists, Klamath Justice Coalition, and others coming together to really push this to the front line.
Work continues to navigate the final regulatory approvals to allow the project to begin in 2022 with a dam removal in 2023. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 23rd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. For Indigenous Heritage Month, host Dime Roberts presents selections from the Storyteller series, a collection of Alaska Native folktales. Then at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Two U.S. senators are demanding a government investigation into rehab centers that use patient labor for little or no pay. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin formally requested an investigation from the Government Accountability Office into federally funded rehab programs that use unpaid labor from people seeking addiction treatment. Reporting done by Reveal showed that at least 300 programs across the U.S. used unpaid workers, including three facilities in Oregon. Often, the work that patients had to do was overly strenuous or dangerous without proper training. These programs are largely unregulated and unlicensed, but in many cases, patients don't have the ability to advocate for themselves, be it about the hazardous nature of their work or their lack of pay. The letter calls these patients a shadow workforce. Many of those who end up in this shadow workforce do so on a court order. If they don't complete the program, they could end up in jail. Senators Warren and Baldwin wrote in their letter to the Accountability Office, quote, "Individuals struggling with substance use disorder who attend rehabilitation programs should never be subjected to predatory conditions that threaten their recovery and violate their rights under the law." Back in July, I spoke with one of the senior editors at Reveal about their investigation into rehab centers and unpaid labor.
Yeah, no, I'm really serious. I really want you guys to... I mean, there has to be laws being broke here. People working like that... I mean, that's slave labor. I mean, we outlawed slavery.
My name's Laura Starcheski. I am one of the reporters and producers on Reveal's American Rehab Project.
So during the current Black Lives Matter movement, attention has been called to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery except as a punishment for a crime. Prison labor is both legal and prevalent in this country, which has led to a number of boycotts of companies who use it. It's actually sort of common with what you see at the grocery store. But it's not the only way work without pay is employed in this country, if you'll pardon the pun. And one of those is what's known as work therapy through rehab facilities. And you did an investigation into that topic. Can you walk me through some of your findings?
Sure, I'd be glad to walk you through some of the findings. We had a team of reporters looking into rehabs that send people to work for no pay or for pennies on the dollar at Reveal for the past almost 4 years. And our investigation started with one rehab in Oklahoma that was sending people to work for no pay at a chicken plant. And from there, the reporters who started the project, Shoshana Walter and Amy Julia Harris, they started hearing about other rehabs. They found one in North Carolina that was sending people to work at an assisted living facility. And then they got curious about just how big this phenomenon actually is. And there's no one federally tracking how many rehabs are sending people out to work and not paying them. So our team took it on and ended up finding that about 60,000 people a year minimum go through these kinds of programs in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big number. It's we weren't sure just exactly what we would find at the beginning. And it's a minimum number because a lot of the programs that were on our list as potentially doing this didn't want to disclose details about how they operate, where they're sending people to work, or whether or not they're paying them. So we know that there are more rehabs out there doing this.
Right, and rehab facilities, generally speaking, are pretty majorly unregulated.
That's right. Most of the facilities on our list, we found about 300 of them in almost every single state, and most of them are not licensed. So that means that essentially there's no one checking even basic things like, are people even getting a treatment that works? Are the people in this rehab safe? Are they actually getting help with their recovery? What kind of outcomes are there? There's no one watching to make sure that the treatment is humane and effective.
And what sorts of labor did you find were included in these work therapies?
We found so many different jobs that people were doing while they were in rehab. So everything from picking cotton and pecans on a farm in Georgia to maintaining oil rigging in Louisiana to doing security at Houston Astros baseball games to building luxury apartment complexes in the Bay Area in California. So people could be working in thrift stores, they could be roasting coffee, they could be making candles and essential oils. We found a lot of dangerous jobs, people doing tree trimming without proper training or equipment, people doing electrical work without proper training, and people doing a lot of work in Louisiana and Texas working in the oil and gas and petrochemical industry.
One day you might go work at a restaurant. The next day, you might go work at a place that bags up mulch, where you're throwing 50-pound bags of mulch for 12 hours. That was usually a punishment job. If you got in trouble, that's where they sent you. I did scaffold building, painting, insulation, and power washing and sandblasting. Man, out here working 84 hours a week for nothing, for peanuts.
We worked 8 hours a day from 7 o'clock to 3.
10 hours a day.
From Monday to Saturday, you work about 54 hours.
And God forbid it rains, because every day you miss for rain, you lose a Sunday. So if you get a week of rain, you're working for, 6 months straight.
And normally those would be things that are regulated by OSHA.
That's right. And, I do want to point out, if people get injured on the job and they're a rehab participant, there have been OSHA complaints and reports made about those injuries. We unfortunately even found several deaths in these kinds of rehabs where people who had been injured on the job died. And those injuries and deaths could be reported to OSHA.
Okay, but the type of training or equipment that might normally be supplied for someone doing paid work instead of work therapy are not available.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are examples out there of rehabs that, say, are sending someone in to work at a petrochemical plant and end up, giving them proper equipment, taking the time to train them. Sometimes just to get into some of those jobs, you have to go through a certain amount of bureaucracy and safety training. So there may be instances where people do get proper training, but at one rehab that we looked at, the Senecor Foundation, which was running facilities in Louisiana and Texas, we found over 24 injuries going back years from rehab participants. There, we found people who had mangled hands, broken backs, and even a death going back to the 90s.
So thinking about work therapy, is there evidence that it's effective? I know that it's been sort of credited as a way to try to break substance abuse in people.
There's no scientific research that shows that making people work without pay is an effective treatment for addiction. Our reporting focused on the opioid epidemic because we trace the roots of these programs back to a program from the 1950s that was started and ended up serving people who were using heroin at that time, when there really were so few options for them and nothing that resembled a treatment program. And what's special and unique about treating opioid addiction is that we actually do have a sense of what the most effective treatment is. It's a daily medication. And taking a daily medication when you're trying to recover from an opioid addiction can reduce your risks, can reduce your risk of death over 50%. But instead of offering people what we know can save their lives, we are turning to unproven methods like sending people to work without pay.
Right, it seems rather exploitative.
A lot of the people that we talked to for the reporting, and we spoke with hundreds of people who've been through programs like this, said that they felt brainwashed by the programs, that they felt afraid while they were in them, and they were afraid to leave, and that they felt dehumanized, that they weren't valued. The psychological distress that being put in a program like this can cause, I really don't think you can overestimate it.
Well, we used to tell people, yeah, we brainwash them because their brain is dirty. And it is. It's full of heroin and morphine and wine and whiskey and cigarettes and lying and cheating and stealing. Yeah, we brainwash them.
At times, I felt so trapped.
This place took a real mental toll on me. I felt like I was a slave there.
It's almost like they try to literally brainwash you.
I remember saying I would stay there at least, I would stay there 3 months. That was it. I would have this figured out. I stayed at Center Core 11 years. 11 years. I stayed there under a dictator named Luke Austin.
Would it be fair to say to your mind that it's a problem with the system rather than a few abusive actors taking advantage of this work therapy situation?
I think overall it is a systemic failure that's led to the conditions that lets these kinds of rehabs thrive. And I would point to a couple of factors in that. One is the rise of mass incarceration coming out of the war on drugs. So we went from tens of thousands of people in prison for drug charges to hundreds of thousands of people in prison for drug charges. And that led to overcrowding and situations where many courts are looking for somewhere else to send people and to put them, either for benevolent reasons so that they can actually get treatment and get the help they need, or simply because their prison and jail system is overcrowded and overtaxed and they just can't keep accommodating so many people. So what we really found was a prison to rehab pipeline, because a lot of people end up getting court ordered into these programs. And when that happens, it means that they may have a felony charge hanging over them. They may have years or decades in prison hanging over them if they do not complete the program. So it kind of adds a whole layer of vulnerability and exploitation to the equation. And then the other structural issue is that there was a Supreme Court case showing that this setup of sending people in rehab to work and not paying them is illegal. It violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. And even if you are giving people room and board in exchange for their work, you still need to pay them a minimum wage. Yet the Department of Labor has barely enforced the Fair Labor Standards Act with rehabs like this. We found only a handful of times when they investigated and found violations at work-based rehabs. And then when they did find violations, we found that the follow-through was missing. So even if back wages were owed, they were not paid out, and rehabs were allowed to continue to operate in this way.
So in researching rehab facilities and work therapy, did you come across common misconceptions that people might have, or put another way, what is it that most people may not understand about this issue?
I think in general, there's a tendency to treat people who are struggling with addiction in this country as if they have some kind of a moral failing. And that's the basis that a lot of these programs function on, that there's something wrong with you if you are using opioids or other drugs or drinking, and that you need to be taught to operate in some more moral fashion.
The vast majority of folks that I deal with are basically bottom feeders. They've been losers since the day they were born. They had a crackhead mama and a dopehead daddy, or no mama or no daddy. They kicked them out of church. They kicked them out of Little League. They've never achieved anything and don't know how to achieve it. They're basically looking for the perfect welfare state where the do-gooders take care of them.
Instead of treating addiction as a medical problem, one doctor that we spoke with who specializes in addiction medicine made a great analogy that I think explains it. You know, we wouldn't take someone with cancer and say that they have a moral failing and being made to work for no pay will somehow teach them how to overcome their cancer. We know that there are proven treatments to help people, especially with opioid addiction, and those can be delivered in a healthcare setting. They don't even need to be delivered in a residential treatment facility. Studies have shown that just the daily medication, taking a daily medication, what's sometimes called medication-assisted treatment, medications like buprenorphine or methadone, those medications reduce your risk of dying of an overdose, and you don't even have to be in a facility to take them. So I think, you know, treating addiction like it's a moral failing leads to people being put in these kind of exploitative situations where they sometimes spend years of their lives. They don't complete the programs. The graduation rates at one of the rehabs we really focused on that I mentioned, the Senecor Foundation, less than 8% of people going through that program graduate. And when you don't succeed in a program like this, you're very vulnerable to relapse and you're very vulnerable to overdosing and dying. So those really are the stakes, life and death.
So for folks who might be hearing this and, you know, are alarmed by the impact that this can have, what is there to be done about it? What action can folks take?
I think education is a big one. You know, before we did this reporting, there was no national list of rehabs that are sending people to work and not paying them. People can go on our website at revealnews.org and find that list. If you just look up the American Rehab Project, you can find it. And you can at least now get a look at how many of these programs are operating in your state. You can search by state and find out what's near you and what's happening. And if you're alarmed by this, I would recommend getting in touch with your lawmakers, your representatives, and letting them know that you find this to be an exploitative model and you think that there needs to be more regulation of the rehab industry.
Do you have any closing thoughts for us before we wrap up?
I think I would just offer a closing thought to people who are dealing with addiction and families who are dealing with addiction, which is just to, you know, if you are seeking help for yourself or for a loved one, I would just encourage people to ask if rehabs that you're looking into use evidence-based treatment methods and to take the time to ask about their success rates. Whether they're a work-based rehab or not.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I was glancing through your Senecor booklet, and I liked the very first sentence I read. In all the years that Senecor has been in business, rehabilitating lives, we have found that nothing works as well as work itself. Work Work is therapy. You feel better about yourself when you have something productive to do.
Laura Starcheski is a senior editor at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Special thanks to Laura and the team at Reveal for use of some of their reporting. Their new serialized investigation is called American Rehab. You can hear it by subscribing to Reveal wherever you get your podcasts. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
All right, so this is one of our favorite segments here on COVID Noise Filter, and that is our public health review. Here are a couple of great stories for us to go over. The first will be under the category of viral transmission. And one of the most important questions is, who's at highest rates of COVID-19 infections in a hospital setting? In other words, when we're looking at an area where you have the highest rates of infections, that of course is going to be the hospital, who is most at risk? So this was a study that happened in New Jersey out of Rutgers University. They looked at 4,000 employees, and what they found was those that are phlebotomist and maintenance and housekeeping staff far and away had higher rates of antibodies and actual virus, were actively infected, may have been asymptomatic, compared to nurses and physicians. Now, the authors do admit that they can't tell if the infections came from communities versus the hospital, but what they did admit was that the hospital administration may have prioritized the health of the physicians and nurses over that of the workers who did not come in contact with patients. And while this breaks my heart every time I talk about the study and every time I have to read it, I do appreciate that the authors of the study did come clean and were forthcoming with that. Doc, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we knew and we suspected, and it's the unsung heroes.
That's right.
That no one talks about.
That's
when
right.
We think about hospitals, we think about healthcare, we think about the doctors and the nurses, and that's all people talk about. No, it's everyone that allows the system to be able to function. It's MAs, it's custodians, it's people that work in the cafeteria, and they go in every day. When there's shortages of PPEs, they suffer as well.
That's exactly right. And it's so important for us to remember that the hospital support staff needs to be looked after and cared for just as the physicians and nurses are. And so I hope that a study like this is going to raise the awareness of hospital administrators. All right. So what does Pfizer's COVID vaccine results really mean? Okay, so we're going to talk about Pfizer's, and then we'll talk about Moderna's. On the day of this recording, Moderna also had just come out with their claim of a 94.5% efficaciousness of their vaccine. But let's be very clear, there's two different words that we want to use here. A virus is efficacious in the setting. In fact, Doc Griggs should be talking about this because he's the expert in clinical trials. But when you're in a clinical trial, you talk about something being efficacious. When you're out in the real world, you talk about something being effective.
Real world, you talk about, does it work?
All right, so here was the first compelling evidence that vaccine can prevent COVID-19, but there's still a lot of questions about it. So first off, the vaccine candidate is called the BNT162b2. I'm sure they will have a new name for it. And what it did show was that it was found to be more than 90% efficacious in preventing COVID-19 in the participants. The analysis evaluated 94 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in trial participants. Now, the study enrolled almost 44,000 participants, but let's be very clear, at the time that they did the study, at that time they only had about 30,000 participants as well. And just a quick behind the curtain sneak peek, Moderna also had about the same amount of confirmed cases of COVID-19 with about 30,000 patients. So we do see some equivalency of the results. But there are some questions that remain, and I just want to go over those real quick and pick Dr. Riggs's mind about this. One, the nature of infections that the vaccine can protect against. We don't know about it. Are they mostly mild cases, or do they include significant numbers of moderate and severe cases? So we don't know what kind of cases they prevent.
So that... That's important.
Right.
That's an important detail.
Does it just prevent the severe, but you can still... Right.
Right. It needs to be stratified. I was listening. Was there more? Or no.
Right. No. Okay. We don't know. Okay. So we don't know about that. Now, again, of course, this has been released. This is an announcement by press release. So we haven't seen the final. Okay. So does the vaccine prevent asymptomatic, mildly symptomatic COVID from transmitting the virus? Because a transmission blocking vaccine could really accelerate the end of the pandemic. So that is something that's really important for us. How well does the vaccine work in different groups of participants? Pediatrics, elderly, diverse populations? We don't know.
So we don't have any demographic data.
No demographic. But what they say here, and I'm going to use air quotes, is that 42% had quote unquote diverse backgrounds of the participants in the study.
So they wore different colored shoes? Again, we're just missing important vital data. So I mean,
that joke had soul.
Oh, man. It smells like feet in here.
The last thing is that we don't know what lasting immunity is going to look like.
Yeah, and that's important. I mean, what we're seeing, folks, is Pfizer's done an amazing job. It is an exciting announcement. What this does say, just based on what we've heard, is that there's progress in that area of attack.
That's right.
Which is why you're seeing other studies like Moderna and everyone following down the path. At least there's a light down the trail that we could investigate. But as scientists, we need more comprehensive data before we can draw any conclusions. Again, I guess our word of the day is we need to just manage our expectations.
That's right. So let's talk about COVID-19 and some current events. So one of the things that's happened over the course of the last week or so, something that Doc Griggs and I both silently said to ourselves, maybe even said it and texted each other about it, like finally, which was that the CDC finally updated their guidance to note that wearing a mask not only protects others, but also protects the user.
Surprise, surprise.
Previously, the agency's guidance focused on limiting potential virus spread to others. And we talked about this a lot here, that the mask act as a source control to block exhaled virus, right? So the virus leaving your mouth. So cloth masks and studies performed on par with surgical masks as barriers for source control. So in other words, those masks that you make at home, they do a great job of blocking the virus from getting out of your mouth. But what they also then added was that the masks also prevent the inhalation of the virus as well. So it protects you not only from exhaling the virus, but also, which protects others,
yep,
but also prevents you from inhaling the virus, which also protects yourself from the virus, Doc.
Who would have thought that if you inhale and exhale and you block the passages in order to do so, it might work both ways?
That's exactly
right. Who knew?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And let me just add to that story real quickly. And we've talked about it on another noise filter. But I just want to also add here that we're very, very happy that President-elect Biden announces a coronavirus task force. This task force will have subgroups that focus on issues related to the response, including testing, vaccine distribution, and personnel protective equipment, PPE. The task force plans on increasing dramatically testing. They're going to build a U.S. public health jobs corps that's going to have 100,000 Americans conduct contact tracing. They're going to also include ramping up production of PPE equipment, as well as implementing a vaccine distribution plan. And I just want to give props to Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, who's an amazing individual. She's going to be co-chair. She's Yale Dean for Health Equity Research. Dr. David Kessler, who's a former FDA commissioner, and Dr. Vivek Murthy. All three of these are going to be co-chairs, and he particularly is the former Surgeon General. But these are three people with a great amount of experience and diversity that I think is going to move us forward in the coronavirus pandemic fight.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast.
Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public